Good evening. It's Sunday, March 17th, 2024. Coming up, as the war rolls on in Gaza, in spite of mounting pressures for a ceasefire with over 32,000 deaths, and the controversial Prop 1 in California is likely to pass by a razor-thin majority, making it possible to divert 30% of funding from local mental health resources and lessening the threshold of conservatorships, many people are scratching their heads about what to do or where to turn in the forthcoming election. Today, we'll talk with W. Kamau Bell.
It's up to all of us individually to participate in that sea change. A very small percentage of that is voting. Most of it is work you do every day.
And Kate Schatz.
If you look at history, like how we've had backlashes, how we've made incredible progress and then have slid backwards, I really do believe that that's the case. So there's, that's my little glimpse of optimism.
We're swimming backwards and we'll swing forward again.
That's what I'm trying to get.
And with an East Bay woman of Palestinian ancestry in the Bay named Nadine, about what all of this means and what work they are doing, even in the face of what many are calling a bleak moment in time.
It's time to make war and weapons obsolete.
I'm Sharon Sabota, and you're listening to the Weekend Evening News.
My name is W. Kamau Bell.
W. Kamau Bell says it's more important for people to rely on ourselves and each other to make change than to wait for things to be solved through an election.
You know, America is going to go through a sea change no matter who the next president is, and it's up to all of us individually to participate in that sea change. A very small percentage of that is voting. Most of it is work you do every day, and so I sort of look to the people who are doing the work every day, bigger than, more powerful than I can do it, and try to take their example and do the work the way I can do it. So, I think it's really a moment where we all get to decide, do we want to be on the right side of history? And America is a country that was allegedly built on supporting people's freedom and liberty. And when you put it that directly, not that we did that, we didn't do that, and we still don't do it, but if you put that directly, it's very clear whose side we should be on if we want freedom and liberty for and justice for all.
You were talking about well-meaning moderate white people,
mm-hmm.
and maybe how they might hold up the status
mm-hmm.
quo.
Mm-hmm.
Is this the election where we think beyond that?
I would encourage people, if you've never voted before, there's actually a lot more critical voting for you in the local races in your community, where you can really make and influence decisions that are about your community's life and livelihood and well-being. And while you're there, pick a president. Like, you're already there, pick a president. But really, I feel like that's what made me understand the power of voting, is local elections, local committee races, local city council. Those are the people who actually can change the face for your city for the good or for the worse. So, and while you're there, pick a president.
On the topic of Israel's U.S.-backed war on Gaza that has now killed more than 30,000 people, W. Kamau Bell drew some parallels between the experiences that Black Americans have endured in the United States and the experiences that many Palestinians are enduring today.
I was lucky to be raised by some super, and I be raised, I mean surrounded by, since I was high school, like some super radical left-leaning Jewish people who always let me understand there's a difference between being a Jewish person and being a citizen of Israel, and those two things are not always the same, and that they shouldn't be conflated. So it's very, and I feel very lucky about that because I didn't choose that. That's just the kid I sat next to in high school whose dad was that way. Shout out to Jason Smith, and rest in peace, Jonathan Smith from University of Chicago. And so for me, as a Black person in this country, when you hear the story of Palestine, it so maps to the story of being Black in America that it's hard not to have so much empathy, deep empathy for Palestinians. And so I'm following the Palestinian American activists around me who are saying, here's the causes you should support. And what my platform is generally for is not preaching, it's for pointing in the right direction of things I think should. So that's what I've been doing with my platform.
Okay, final thing. Why is it important to look at race and gender together?
I just talked about pointing at the resources. Kimberly Crenshaw, Professor Kimberly Crenshaw, who's credited with the idea of intersectionality, is just like, these identities work in tandem. They don't work separately. So why would we not understand that there's a difference between when we say Black people say this, Black men say this, Black women say this, when we break it down. So it never helps to conflate all these things together.
Thank you so much.
No problem.
Appreciate it.
That was comedian, activist, producer, and author of the book Do the Work, Kamau Bell. Kate Schatz is the author of the Radical Women series and the co-author of the book called Do the Work that she wrote along with Kamau Bell. Schatz says now is as good of a time as ever to start doing the work.
The idea for the book came kind of out of the summer of 2020 in the wake of the uprising that happened after the murder of George Floyd in May of 2020. And Kamau and I were both have been involved for a really long time and in organizing for social and racial justice. We were both really involved in kind of talking to folks in the wake of the Floyd murder. And in particular, I was talking to a lot of white people, both on social media and in real world spaces about what to do, about why this happened, trying to help white people better understand their own complicity in white supremacist systems and what they can do. And we really wanted to do something together that could kind of harness the energy of that time and put it in book form, because we knew that that energy wouldn't be sustained. And Kamau asked if I wanted to write a book, and I said absolutely. And we got together over Zoom, because it was 2020,
right.
Was still the
everything
pandemic.
Was in Zoom. Yep.
So we got together to kind of brainstorm and say, like, what kind of book should we write? And we both pitched the idea of an activity book. And I think that happened for a couple reasons. One is that we're both parents of young kids, so we were home with them. It was during the pandemic. And we were seeing how their teachers were trying to get them engaged. We were desperately trying to keep our kids entertained and engaged.
And how old are your kids again?
So my kids, I have, let's see, at the time, I had 2 second graders and a 7th grader. And Kamau has had 3 under 10 at that time. So we were desperately trying to keep them entertained. So that was kind of front and center for us. But we were also thinking about, you know, there's so many amazing books out there that are intended to give people a history of race and racism in this country and to contextualize it. And those books are brilliant and they're necessary. And a lot of them are like 400 pages.
And then people don't finish,
People don't necessarily finish them. So we wanted to do something that was really different, something that could maybe pull people in. Kamau is a comedian. He uses humor all the time to get at really serious stuff. I've written these books that are for young people that try to be really engaging and accessible and talking about histories that kids maybe wouldn't otherwise be exposed to. So we kind of combined those skills and came up with this kind of absurd, wacky idea of an activity book. But I think it's worked. And again, the idea was to kind of create something that felt playful and fun and kind of unexpected so that we could kind of get people into conversations that maybe they would otherwise be resistant to.
Schatt says the only true way to understand the power structures in the United States is to look at them through an intersectional lens.
Oh, because it's an absolute essential way to understanding how power works and how people's lived experiences play out on a daily basis. I really think that one of the greatest intellectual and academic gifts I ever got was being exposed to the idea of intersectionality when I was 18, taking an intro to feminism course at UC Santa Cruz as an undergrad, and reading Angela Davis for the first time, reading Women, Class, and Power, and being confronted by the idea. I very much remember a professor explaining that there is no such thing as a universal woman. And I'm like my little teenage feminist brain kind of exploded. And it was this understanding that all of these identities intersect, that there is race, there's ability, there's class, there's gender, there's sexuality, all of these things that are all related to power structures and how an oppression, they all absolutely intersect. And to truly understand how to make change, to understand how power works, to understand people's experience in institutions, whether it's the law, the legal system, whether it's schools, whether it's the workplace, we have to understand all of those various factors. And to ignore that, to compartmentalize, it's just lazy, and it just really limits our sense of people's humanity.
You were about to tell me about your novel, and you said it deals with reproductive choice.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I've published 8 books in the last 10 years, and they've all been with collaborators. maybe it's 7 books. Anyway, they've all been with collaborators. I have been working on one novel by myself for those 10 years. And it's finally getting published. So I think that just speaks to my need for collaboration. But the novel is, it takes place in a maternity home. And it's about this kind of hidden history of young girls, mostly white middle class girls who were sent away to have their pregnancies in secret and shame, and then essentially coerced or forced into giving their kids up for adoption. And then leaving these maternity homes, going home, and never speaking of it again.
It's a novel.
It's inspired by my mother's experiences as one of the girls who was sent away in the 1960s when she had unexpected pregnancies. So it kind of takes place right on the cusp, right a few years before Roe. So it's kind of looking at what happened when the kind of sexual revolution in the kind of summer of love and the freedom of the late 60s also came up against the actual limitations on the choices that women had.
Is your mother still alive?
Mm-hmm. She is, yes.
So what does she think about this book coming to fruition?
She's really, really happy about it and really proud. It's been a long journey for her. This was something that she didn't talk about. I didn't find out about this until I was in my 20s, that she had had two pregnancies before giving birth to me with my father. And it was a huge shock to me. And it was something that she had carried with her for decades as just this source of so much pain and shame and sadness. Her telling me, we kind of went on a journey together of talking about it and understanding it, and eventually I decided that I wanted to write about it. And she knew that I was writing the book, but she didn't actually read a draft of it until last year.
And when is it coming out?
It's coming out next year, in 2020, at the end of 2025, I think.
And how did she react when she read it?
It was very intense for me, as both a writer and as a daughter. She was really, really happy and pleased. It's a very, very fictionalized account. It's not even an account of her story. It's really just inspired by her. And then I really spun things out into a very, very different story. But there's a lot of things from her experience are in there. And she felt, I think she felt really validated and really seen by it.
Amazing. And how can it be an act of resistance to share a story, even though it's fictionalized, inspired by these real life events that are not, she's not an anomaly, right?
She's really not. And I think that, you know, giving voice to people's stories, people's lived experiences that have been silenced or were left in the shadows or, repressed, I think it's an act of radical transformation. It sheds light on these things that people don't want us to talk about. And I also think, you know, one of the reasons that I write so much about history is because I think it helps ground us in our present moment and understand how to make better choices for our future. You know, I really cling to this idea that, you know, you have to understand the history in order to understand what you're doing right now in the future. So I really felt that with this particular story, in the context of what's happening with reproductive justice right now, with the devastation of Roe, this is an aspect of reproductive rights history that so many people don't know about. I think people know about illegal abortions. People know about, you know, have an idea of kind of back alley abortion and that kind of danger. But much more common was these other systems of denying women agency over their bodies and agency over their whether or not they could be mothers. So I think that it's another version of what we absolutely want to avoid. So I'm excited to bring it to light a little more.
Yeah, and it's such an important moment. So before we end today, it's mm-hmm. 2024, year of an election.
Yeah.
It looks bleak this year.
Yeah. I'm making a face. I'm making the same exhausted face that of us make.
Yeah. You know, we talked about intersectionality. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people feeling extremely uneasy and very uncomfortable with the situation in the Middle East, and the United States is part in that. Mm-hmm. Not to mention reproductive rights, pushback on, like in states, some people would probably need to have a permission slip to have you and Kamal come and talk about this book.
Yeah, absolutely.
What are you thinking this election cycle? What are you going to do?
These are great questions. I think if I can say anything, it's just that I want to give people permission to just feel terrible about it all. You know, I think it does feel really bleak. I mean, we're, you know, absolutely complicit in funding the genocide in the Middle East and Gaza right now. I feel very, very, very unenthusiastic about the presidential election. And I mean, I think that like my, I really think that we're in the middle of a just really significant, hard socio-political, cultural backlash. And we're smack in the middle of it. And I do think that the pendulum swings. And I think that if you look at history, like how we've had backlashes, how we've made incredible progress and then have slid backwards, I really do believe that that's the case. So there's a, you know, that's my little glimpse
of
optimism.
We're swimming backwards and we'll swing forward again.
That's what I'm trying to get to. And I do actually believe that. You know, I saw a clip, I saw a clip of something the other day, and it was just like, it was like an Obama speech. And it was just like, struck me how that wasn't that long ago. And it wasn't, not that he was perfect and not that that was a perfect time politically, but like how radically different that feels from now. And I actually do believe that it is possible that in a number of years we can get to that, a similar place where things don't actually feel absolutely devastating and chaotic all the time. But that's not the moment we're in right now. And I actually think, if anything, I'm just kind of trying to just be extremely real and honest about how very dark and difficult and bleak this time is. I don't feel rah-rah. I'm not rallying around our Democratic candidate. I'm going to vote for Biden, but like, I'm not happy about it.
You're doing that because you feel like better than Trump, or?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm also in California, so I feel very conscious of like what my vote actually means. So to actually give some, like, to not be totally dispirited in the conversation, what I have done for the last several elections is really put my energy, again, as a California voter with the full knowledge that my presidential vote is, you know, I'm not in a swing state. I know how the system works. I do most of my energy, my activist energy. I'm a big supporter of Black Voters Matter and several other grassroots organizations who are on the ground doing unbelievable work in communities of color, in Black communities, who are doing voter registration, and who are really, I mean, fighting against like just such pernicious voter suppression. So for all of my despair and crappy feelings, like, I really just try to channel that into just pure support for those organizations. That's what's going to move the needle in this election, and it's incredibly necessary. So to some degree, I think that I'm in a process of kind of getting over myself and my own crappy feelings. I'm still kind of, it's March, so I'm still kind of in that place right now. But that to me is the most effective use of time and energy and emotion, is really supporting the people who are in the states that are going to decide this election. It's really essential that it goes the right way. And we've seen the last few elections, we know it's going to come down to a handful of these states. Yeah. So putting our energy into really supporting those organizations on the ground that are run by the people who actually live there, that center the communities that are most impacted by voter suppression, and whose votes we really, really need, lifting them up, giving them money, giving them what they need, is going to be the way to go for this election season.
And some folks aren't feeling comfortable to vote for Biden even because of his positioning. Would you want to send a message to him if you could?
to Biden?
Yes. What would it be?
Aside from like, bro, God, find someone else to run. it'd be stop funding this genocide. Don't build a pier to give aid. Just send the message to Netanyahu that we know that you can send, and cut off funding. Actually listen to the young voters. Like, listen to the actual young people in this country, whose message is loud and clear.
And they're about to come in here, some young voters. And so to end for now, if you had to think of one most important lesson that you've learned on your journey as a...
Ooh.
I know, just that little question, real
just
quick on the fly.
Just little question. The importance of being curious and the importance of listening. And see, I can never just name one thing.
Yeah, that's fine.
Being curious and listening and just being excited to learn things that you don't already know. You know, I think so many of us want to know everything. We want to be experts. And also when it comes to, you know, the work of anti-racism and racial justice, we don't want to get it wrong. We always want to be right. But the real power comes in learning more, learning new things, learning something we didn't know yesterday so that we can continue to do better. So listening to people's stories and being excited to learn more and get better at being ourselves.
That was author Kate Schatz. You're listening to the Weekend Evening News on KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno, K248BR 97.5 in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. I'm Sharon Sabota. In the final segment today, we'll hear from Nadine, a Palestinian American who spent her childhood in Lebanon and later came to the United States.
I'm from Palestine and Lebanon. So my mom is from Palestine, born in Lebanon. My dad is from Lebanon, born in Palestine. And I unfortunately have never been able to go.
Nadine shares her scenic journey in getting to the United States.
I was born and raised in Lebanon to my mom, who was exiled from Palestine, and she carried her pain throughout her exile. And then we were exiled from Lebanon because of the civil war and the Israeli invasion of Lebanon.
So what years are we talking about?
I left in 74. The Lebanese civil war started in 75. The Israeli invasion was in 82.
She's emotional as she shares her family's long journey of displacement and oppression, as she reflects on the complicity of the United States in the situation in Gaza today.
How are you feeling right now?
Terrible. Yeah. Terrible. So when the war on Gaza started and the viciousness of it and the response of the West and the response of the media, and that no matter what Israel is doing, no matter how much of Gaza is destroyed, and the fact that the West is not responding in the right way, just brought for me the reality of the racism. And the fact, this is what I saw, that in this country, they can no longer be outwardly racist. I mean, they are. I mean, they're still, racism is alive and well, but it cannot be spoken of, acted upon legally. But they can do it on the Palestinians. They can do it in Gaza. And of course, there are many layers. We know that. But one of them is the expression of what's going on in Gaza is the expression of the racism of the West towards Muslims, towards Palestinians, towards non-Western people. They don't matter. Their lives don't matter. It doesn't matter. The way they talk about them, the way they don't see them, the way you can destroy a whole... just the way they can talk about Ukraine, the way they respond to Ukraine, the way the international court responded to Ukraine, and the way Gaza has blown up, not can, has. Biden talking from both sides of, I have to be polite.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, come on, people are not idiots.
So what are you gonna do
for me, of course, him talking about racism and doing the work, and it's connecting the dots, right? It's connecting the dots.
So it's the year of an election.
Cornel West is the only one that has been true, has been speaking the truth, has been speaking morally, courageously, has been standing for human, for morality, for human rights, for humans, for the planet, for what is correct. He's the only one who's been out there speaking what needs to be said for everybody and for the Palestinians.
Does anything give you hope right now?
The love. You know, I hear those Palestinians. I see those kids. I hear the Palestinians coming out of Gaza, the Palestinians in Gaza. And the love, the spirituality, the faith. It brings tears to my eyes because they don't give up. Their faith is unbelievable. Their love is unbelievable. The beauty of the children is amazing. I don't want to say resilience.
It makes you emotional.
It does. It does.
If you could send a message to lawmakers, what would it be?
Become a human. Wake up. Wake up. Stop the genocide. Do the right thing. Become a human.
So don't just drop aid, but stop sending weapons.
Of course, stop sending weapons.
Yeah.
Stop this war. Stop the weapons. Do the right thing. Bring justice. Stop the oppression. Stop sending weapons. Stop Stand on the right side of history. Stop the BS. I mean, for crying out loud, what does it take? Seriously, what does it take? Why do we have what we have today? If the Nuremberg trial was real, why do we have what we have today?
Nadine is wearing a keffiyeh and handing out bracelets that say ceasefire now and free Palestine. Because they included the words free Palestine, she wasn't able to share them with the students at the private school she worked at.
So we had a festival celebrating various cultures, and so we did them to distribute. And so I had a whole bunch left.
Okay. And they say ceasefire now.
And free Palestine.
And what are you doing to continue to use your voice? You're making bracelets. You're speaking out.
I speak out because I cannot be quiet. Even though there are times where my speaking is very emotional, and sometimes I am not able to say things in the way I would like to say them, eloquently or intelligently even. Sometimes I can't be intelligent because my emotions take the better of me, but I cannot be quiet. So whenever I can, I will speak and I will pass on information. Like, for example, I was sent a video of an interview with two filmmakers, and the photographer Mataz, who was in Switzerland. There was a festival of human rights, and somebody sent me the video of their conversation. And it was an amazing conversation, amazing, so real. And so I forwarded that hour and a half conversation in front of an audience to my colleagues at work and said, I do hope that you will get to watch it because you will get an insight into what it's like to be Palestinian. Maybe you will get what it's like to be a Palestinian. The pain that Palestinians hold and have held from, let's say, from the Balfour Declaration of 1917, through the partition, through the Nakba, through all the various wars, to today, what's going on in Gaza. It has not stopped.
Nadine shares her scenic journey in getting to the United States.
I was born and raised in Lebanon to my mom, who was exiled from Palestine, and she carried her pain throughout her exile. And then we were exiled from Lebanon because of the civil war and the Israeli invasion of Lebanon.
So what years are we talking about?
I left in 74. The Lebanese civil war started in 75. The Israeli invasion was in 82.
Okay. Anything else you want to add?
It's time for humans to stop, to make war obsolete. We're all humans. I was thinking about that this morning. We're all one human race. There is no there there. There is no there there. It's time to make war and weapons obsolete.
That's the voice of Nadine, a Palestinian American speaking about the ongoing war in Gaza at the expense of Palestinians. And the weather. In the San Francisco Bay Area, partly cloudy tonight with lows in the 50s, partly sunny tomorrow with highs near 70. In the central San Joaquin Valley, lows in the upper 40s tonight and highs in the 70s for tomorrow. That's it for this evening's news. Thanks to Rod Akil, our technical producer, and to you, our listeners, for tuning in. I'm Sharon Sabota. Good evening.